This was fun preparing this because I got to delete most of my motivation slides and all the slides, since I'm in an engineering department, that say why this is going to save the world. Focus on some of the questions that I wanted to bring up. So the question that this talk is going to focus on is how do you grow a structure into a desired shape? And it's stuff that's familiar to a lot of people in the audience, and it builds from a lot of the ideas from a lot of the people in the audience here. I got stumbled on this about 5 years ago when I did a really simple experiment that I still don't understand. And so I'll show you this video, and many of you have seen it before. And I'll tell you that by the end of this talk, I won't have said anything smart about what's about to happen. And so this is something I still don't fully get. But this is a really simple experiment. This is just a sheet of rubber. It's a circle. You're looking at it from two angles. And we placed a droplet of solvent on it. And then it did a bunch of different things. It bent, it buckled, and then it started to twist.
Sorry, what do you mean you placed the broccoli bucket?
Yeah, so we just place a droplet of, so this is silicon rubber, so we place a droplet of a favorable solvent. In our case, it's a hexane or toluene, some sort of organic solvent that'll swell it.
Is it touching or is it just near?
Is it completely coating it?
It is completely coating it.
There it goes. We didn't say go on.
Sorry, just last slow. Time. Yeah. We've done this a bunch of different ways now, so the droplet's kind of messy. We've done it with a spray of like a solvent mist so that it wasn't the solid fluid moving, and it still does the same thing.
So it's not dynamical, or it is
It's not the motion of the droplet on the surface that's doing it, because we've done it where we coat it with like a spray.
It's swelling.
It's swelling, yeah, sorry. So this is silicon rubber, and it's swelling with an organic solvent. We've done it with like a silicon oil, hexane, toluene, anything that'll cause it to get bigger. And I'll talk a little bit more about
this. Okay, is that real time or sped up?
That is real time.
Okay. So that looks to me a bit like the zero stiffness that we were talking about. That you've got a buckling, bistable, like a bimetallic sheet. You're heating the top surface.
Sure.
It's spreading. Mm-hmm. It's going to buckle into a cylindrical shape at some point. About which axis? Could be any axis.
Well, that is actually the second half of my talk, so we'll be good. Yeah, and so exactly. And so, yeah. I mean, that's the hand-waving argument we've made, which is to say, well, it's a circle, and so it's perfectly happy in any state, and if you kind of perturb it, then the energy for it to go from being in this shape to this shape is really small, and so you should be okay. And that's what we've done in a hand-waving sort of argument, and when we write down the energy, and when we minimize the energy of the shape and say, hey, you know, there should be some theta dependence if we can kind of input an energy, it seems like everything is equal. What we know is that we don't see this as we go to elliptical shapes.
So does it have up-down symmetry, or it has an effect of gravity? Because it looks like it's more bent down now.
Yeah, and the stuff is rolling down the hill a little bit.
That's what I'm saying. I redid the experiment where there's no stuff rolling down.
It does the same thing.
And it's coming back up. It just takes a really long time.
But it comes back to a flat state.
It comes back to a flat state.
Okay, so the stuff just evaporates out and it goes back to that.
So. There's a hand waving argument for me makes sense. We just haven't been able to show anything like, well, how fast is it going to go and all that.
And like, if you repeat the experiment, it's going to like go with the oscillate like rotate with a different speed and
similar speed, different possibly different direction. Sometimes it'll go one way and stop and then go the other way. We mostly just have experiments on this and very little smart to say about it other than these kind of hand waving. But this idea of taking a sheet of rubber and swelling it locally or globally is kind of what took me off on the path of what I'll talk about today. And so we'll talk about things like the bending direction as I go further. But hopefully this kind of sets the stage of one puzzle that we don't understand. The talk will be made up of a bunch of stuff that I think we understand, followed by a few things at the end that we don't yet. So, like I said, a lot of this is motivated by stuff from many of you, and we're really doing a lot of the same things. On the one hand, there's the question of going forward, which is, putting in some sort of mixed gel, which is going to swell locally more so than in other regions, and say what shape is going to form. And this is work that's familiar to most of us. And on the other side is the inverse problem, which is saying, like, okay, I want to make a particular shape, so how do I pattern this surface to swell and grow in a desired way? Most of what we're going to talk about is not in the inverse form, which is saying we know what shape we want. We're going to go the other way, which is to say, okay, if we put two materials together and ask one part to stretch and the other one not, what shape will form? And so it'll be in that context that a lot of what I'll talk about today will come up. This is familiar to all of you, and the only reason I put it up here is because the way we've been thinking about some of these things is in the context of what we've been saying as a geometric composite. So a material in which we can understand it by stitching together different geometries. And so taking a cone and saying that it's a stitch together of a flat sheet with kind of, you know, of one particular shape, and we force it to bond to a wedge of this shape here, and this thing has to, if you force it to this one, to grow, to be glued to this edge, and this one to be glued to this edge, this can't be flat anymore, and it's going to form a cone. So we've been kind of using this idea of a geometric composite to help us make sense of some of the mechanics. So to put that in a more definitive context, you know, if you think about, say, stitching together a disc whose radius is smaller than the inside of this annular ring's radius, but you say we're going to force this by stretching it or by compressing this to bond together, and you let go, and you say, well, what's going to happen? Well, it's going to adopt a saddle-like geometry. The opposite kind of geometric composite of stitching together two geometries would be taking a disc whose radius is larger than this inner hole here, and so then you'd have to stretch the annulus and glue it to the disc, or compress the disc and glue it to the annulus. And if you do that, you again go from being, both of these things were initially flat, and now you have something that is a spherical shape. So we're going to eventually talk about using swelling, kind of how that initial video motivated things with swelling, to make these shapes. But first we're going to do it just mechanically, just kind of doing the math for the words I just said.
These are experiments on the right-hand side?
What's that? These are experiments. We took an annulus and we...
stretch it mechanically?
We mechanically compressed it over this thing, and then we mechanically stretched the annulus. Compressed the disc inside this annulus here, and so this is what pops up. And our goal was, before we did the swelling stuff, was to predict these shapes. And so, again, this is what we're going to be using throughout the whole talk. This is our elastic energy density in terms of both stretching and bending. And it's familiar to all of you, so I don't...
How do you account for the edge, or is there no edge where you glue these two together?
So the nice thing is that these materials are both silicon rubber, and the way we glue the two silicon rubber sheets together is we use liquid silicon rubber that's going to cross-link into being the same material. So in the end, the glue ends up being the same material, so pretty much...
I should really think of it as just one material.
Eventually, it's like one material. I don't think it's perfectly one material, but it's not too bad. So
if it's a rubber, so... can we really think about it? So it's typically very it's this kind of rubber elasticity, so it's very Neo-Hookian sort of response.
Everything
in a regime, so that's basically the question.
Everything that we end up doing, we think is reasonable in terms of kind of the small strain, large deflection, displacement, or large rotation formalism. We make this so that we don't have to stretch it too much, because it's actually really hard to get it to stretch too much. And so everything we did for these experiments and going forward, I think the small strain approximation is
But really the assumption of constant thickness is okay. So for rubber, I'm not... because typically if you stretch a rubber, even if you stretch it a little bit, you can absorb most of the strain through changing the thickness, and that's basically what I mean by rubber elasticity. So
no, I know, and I think it's okay. So we verified a lot of this stuff numerically, where we were just doing a fully kind of 3D elastic funnelism in it, and it seems to be okay. And so I don't know where the limit is, but I think we're okay. So this energy I know is familiar, and so what we're gonna do is recognize that, you know, we're obviously forcing this thing to stretch. We're stretching one part or the other, and so we know that this is gonna be dominated by that stretching, and so we expect the sheet will be able to essentially bend as much as possible to accommodate the amount of stretch that we've applied. And so essentially what we're doing is we're taking that elastic energy, we're throwing away the bending term and minimizing the stretching energy. And so this is really what kind of we're trying to do here. So if we had taken just a disk and we just look at the azimuthal metric as you go out along the radius, so this is the center of the disk, this is the edge, you know, if it would follow this curve if we did nothing at all. This would just be a flat circular disk. This is in polar coordinates. And so what we're doing is we're saying, okay, well, the center part is going to be that flat part, and at some arbitrary point, we're going to have a discontinuous jump in the metric. And so, go ahead. So this is the, essentially you're going to get this is the x-axis is the radial coordinate. It's normalized by the amount we're stretching it. And the y-axis is the azimuthal component of the metric tensor. And then it's normalized by the initial radius of it. So you can think of this as, okay, so this, if
why
you're...
Why is it the clean now?
Yes.
It's R squared.
Because it's a metric.
It's a square. Okay.
Yeah.
It's just a parabola.
It's a metric. Just a parabola. Oh. But it's two parabolas because we're stitching together the one parabola of the inner one with the parabola of the outer one. And so there's a jump, a discontinuous jump where we kind of glue them together.
The metric or the target metric?
This is the...
it's the intrinsic metric.
It's the metric.
Target metric.
Yeah.
It's not what the actual distances are.
No, exactly.
So, you said in your numerics, I guess you want to show us, you neglect the bending entirely?
In the analytical form that we're going to describe here, we neglect the bending entirely. In the numerics, we don't. So, in the way we're trying to basically match these two curves here, analytically is by ignoring bending, writing down the stretching energy, essentially it's kind of treating this as there's a discontinuous jump where if you're over here, this kind of stretching term is just one, and if you're beyond wherever you decided to kind of glue that annulus, then your stretching term becomes however much you mechanically stretched it, which is that alpha term. It's alpha squared.
What do you mean by incompressible there?
We mean that nu is 1/2.
So that you're assuming not Kirchhoff love, but you're assuming as some sort of uniform.
Exactly.
Actually, it's not uniform, right? A non-uniform thickness change.
Then. Yeah. We're assuming that there will be a thickness change. Yeah.
So f of r, when it is larger than big R, it multiplies both right. Components.
It multiplies...
Of the 1 and the r square...
So depending on where you are, it's going to... Yeah, it'll multiply both components. But then we do this right here. So yeah. So the next thing we do is we say that the... we're going to say the only non-negligible strain will be in the azimuthal component. So we'll say that A... RR and A bar RR are essentially the same. And so that's one of the three assumptions we make in doing this is we say that the what's happened, the difference in the radial components is negligible. And so we just say, okay, we'll just consider the difference in the azimuthal components.
So if your material is incompressible, and you do this experiment, does it mean that the inner disk is thinner than the outer disk and would that sort of impede
you mean
the
initially
fluidity?
Or afterwards?
Afterwards.
Afterwards,
initial,
afterwards it'll mean that the one that was stretched started out thinner, and then you let go and it goes back to the same, roughly. not exactly the same thickness.
So then, but that means in the end, your whole piece is not really
it's not perfectly. It's not homogeneous.
Eventually, some line energy contribution from matching the thickness.
Yeah. So basically, we end up stretching the annulus, sticking it on the disc. Yeah. Now the annulus at that point is thinner, and then as you let go, the annulus is going to go back to its original thickness, but now the disc is going to get bigger.
Okay. There's some shear contribution to elastic energy, which we're not just neglecting.
We're neglecting it.
There somewhere because of a small gradient and.
Exactly. Thickness. It is there, and we're neglecting it. And hopefully it's reasonable. We think it's okay. So we took the stretching energy and basically we can go through this, I can toggle this if you want, we just moved it from polar coordinates to Gauss normal coordinates, and then writing down the first fundamental form where we neglect, again, the radial contribution of the metric tensor. We can write down the Gaussian curvature in these Gaussian normal coordinates. And then what we're going to do is minimize the stretching energy, and this is the next assumption we make, which is that that the surface will adopt a deformed state with a constant Gaussian curvature. Is that true? It's not bad. So this is our the numerical results of the Gaussian curvature as a function of the radius. These are for two different kind of points, and the where we stitch an annulus this big, and then this one here is stitching an annulus of close to a half, and so it's not bad.
Is it always for the elliptic case, or is this for both cases that you're doing this?
Is it always for the elliptic case? No, for both cases we're doing this, and these are two examples from the hyperbolic case. And the hyperbolic case had a slightly more of a deviation as you got to the edge than the elliptic case. But in general, the Gaussian curvature was roughly constant towards the edge of the disk. So that's the second big assumption we made.
The hyperbolic one had a bigger variation towards the edge than the elliptic, because we would think the elliptic would have to become more hyperbolic near the edge.
I'll check. I'll show. It'll pop up here on the graph, and I can check to make sure that I'm not saying that wrong. So it's going to show up on the graph in a second. So we make this assumption that there's going to be a constant Gaussian curvature. It's not bad from what we've seen numerically, and that leads us to this form of the kind of azimuthal stretch essentially. And the next thing we do, this is the third assumption, is we assume that the Gaussian curvature is going to be fairly small relative to the stretch over the outer radius of the structure, which basically means that this thing can't curve to the point, have a curvature, a principal curvature of on the order of 1 over the outer radius. For all of our cases, this is not bad either. This is usually close to, if we compare the Gaussian curvature times the outer radius, it's close to 0.
Can you say when we should expect these assumptions to hold? Because there are cases, suppose the disk is very, very thin, for example, in which this step will appear and all these.
We know that this is going to break down. We know that there's a bunch of assumptions in here that we happen to be working in a bit of a sweet spot. And that sweet spot, there's just two parts to it. One is that we're not thin enough so that we start to see these, the constant Gaussian curvature break down. We've been trying to do experiments to see if we can get there, but we haven't gotten there yet. And so, these things are all, I'll show you in a second, a few centimeters in diameter and maybe a millimeter in thickness. We haven't gotten to the point yet where we see this, the multiple lobes where we get the constant Gaussian curvature would break down. The other reason why we're kind of in the sweet spot, and you'll see this when I show another graph in a minute, is that as that inner radius gets really, really small, the idea that this thing is going to have a constant Gaussian curvature, that it's going to be smooth, it breaks down too. I'll show you, I have a quantitative answer to at least that part as to where that breaks down.
Which is in the thick limit, you mean?
In the thick limit, exactly. In the thick limit, the constant Gaussian curvature idea will break down too as you get to a really small inner disk.
So basically there is no variation of thickness in the, in the regime. So you did not really vary the thickness in order to show.
We haven't yet, and that's what we want to do. We haven't done that yet, because it's kind of it basically got to be a pain to do the stretching with the
scale. So the dark should go one slide backwards, maybe. Can you? Mm-hmm. So the thing that bothers me, and I think I mentioned, there are some people did very similar problems, not in circular but in ribbons. I think Chris and Angelo worked on this, and Michael did similar things. And the thing that bothers me is that it is known that this physical mechanism is wrong. Like, the physical mechanism is that this is actually not is what should be minimized. This term, the compression, is what should be the constraint. What is minimized is really the bending cost of the jump versus the residual radial stretching. And once you do this together, you get the length scale boundary layer, which depends, you just get how this thickness-dependent mechanism for going from one metric to another metric. And you can cover all type of thicknesses with this. And so this is basically, in my view, the wrong physics, what you do.
Well, he has a strong jump in the metric, so it's different.
But even if you have,
if you have a thick enough sheet, I think it'll smooth out something like this. Right. Might be reasonable.
Then you have
when he said it will appear, it's a wide boundary which spans the entire thing.
Right, that's like what I'm saying. We are,
But you should find it with the same mechanism. Why this mechanism of this is constrained, this is actually should be zero identically, you don't minimize it. Require this to be zero, and what you minimize is the radial.
You cannot see your radial.
There's a discontinuity.
Yeah, you mean bending term. You have bending and radial.
You can't make the stretching zero. It can't be a constraint because the metric is discontinuous. And Chris and I had a similar thing with the bistrip.
Yes, you too. But then bending is important. The
bending is secondary. But I mean, more of you can't make. You can't start by making the stretching energy zero because you can't make a discontinuous metric. We can't make this thing discontinuous. So he starts by trying to get as close as possible to the stretching energy.
I don't see why this term, why sigma, why a theta theta cannot be discontinuous. I think what cannot be called discontinuous is sigma rr. This is the thing that should not, or arr. This is what should not go.
So you have a discontinuity in arr too?
No, you don't have. This is what will be balanced by the bending. That's why you need
R, a r r is.
And this is what will be minimized. Under the constraint, this is identically zero. This is the mechanism of boundary.
You'll have a discontinuity.
No, there will be a discontinuity.
Yes, discontinuity in both.
There's a discontinuity in both, because we have to compress that outer.
Yeah,
angles.
No. There's a discontinuity in both.
Just equilibrium.
They still don't see under what mechanism this is the only thing to be minimized.
Discontinuity in that either.
No, the bending is a much smaller contribution than this. Here, there, in some ways, it's being forced so hard that you have to worry about the stretching as a dominant thing.
Because but stretching only in the hoop direction, not in the radial.
The one difference is bending both directions. We didn't assume
that here you don't have to ARR.
Guys, you want to hear the rest of the talk. Before we run out of time.
All right, so I'll show you that if you do this, and then we do one more final step, which is the last thing I was saying, which is assuming this Gaussian curvature is small, you can Taylor expand this term here, and to get a quadratic, an energy that's quadratic in the Gaussian curvature. And what all that leads to is that you get this smooth form for your azimuthal stretching component, which is that gray line there. And so then if you go and do a bunch of experiments, there's the numerics, which is a fully 3D, we basically take a disk and an annulus, and we apply a 3D isotropic distortion to the annulus or the disk. And that's what the numerical results are, which work really well, except for near the edge where we see a little bit of deviation due to the our assumption that this thing is going to have a constant Gaussian curvature. And our experiments also land nicely on there. And again, they agree more with the numerics than with our analytics near the edge, but do pretty well. This is for the hyperbolic case. For the elliptical shape, where you're going to have it drop down in terms of its metric. Again, you see something similar. And I think I was backwards, James, that it deviates more with this case here than the hyperbolic. No, I think that's what I said. I don't remember. Whatever. This is the one where it deviates more. And so it works pretty well. The analytical approach captures everything except for as you get to the outer edge, and it captures that nice smoothing of the discontinuity pretty nicely. Yeah.
So that works really well, by the way. When Chris and I were thinking of the bi-strip, we were in a regime mostly where we did not assume that things would be uniform all the way through, that there was going to be sort of a smooth interpolating step or something between two. I mean, it's obviously a different problem. Mm-hmm. But my guess would be that if you had a larger experiment, mm-hmm. that maybe that would also be the case here, that you would see something that sort of hugs one curve, then
yep.
smoothly goes to the other and hugs the other. Have you done anything?
And so this is kind of what we see. We had trouble doing getting the experiments to work because I'm not sure if we just stopped trying before we got it. But if we do the numerics, this is something that we see down here, which is that like as you get to a smaller and smaller inner disk or really, really large outer annulus comparatively, it stops working, basically. And this is, I'm assuming what you're seeing there is that, you know, you're going to have this kind of boundary layer between the two regimes, and it's going to be, you know, less than the total.
But you haven't done like a big inner disk and a big outer annulus or something like that.
How big?
I don't know how big it would need to be, but basically big enough that the transition is localized rather than globally.
So we've tried to make big-ish ones by swelling, and I'll show you one in a second, but by mechanically stretching, it's just really hard to do it.
You can do it numerically, though, maybe, right?
We can do it numerically, yeah.
I'd just be curious if there's some transition to localizing the... A transition to localizing the transition.
I just wanted to say that the assumption of zero radial strain, mm-hmm. in a way, is inconsistent with the half Poisson ratio, because you have
yep.
a sinusoidal strain. So I think that might be the you know the boundary mismatch in a way, because this boundary effect is basically relies on this Poisson ratio and so. Maybe if you introduce the radial strain, which is proportional to the azimuthal strain, you might get the boundary right.
So maybe. So we went, and so I was always uncomfortable with dropping the radial strain. We, you know, for everything in the regimes that we were doing our experiments, and then we had this agreement, numerically we saw that it was small. It was smaller than the azimuthal strain. And so I imagine...
Like twice more?
I don't know. I don't know the answer off, but I know that it was small enough that we were comfortable neglecting it. But I don't know that it's fair to do at all points. And so, yeah.
Is this like in the form of a typical axisymmetric problem where you've got the radial and azimuthal complementary? You have a constant plus one over r squared, constant plus something over r squared. The other one is a constant minus something over r squared. Is that valid for you too? Is that
Does
that say anything about
I don't know.
If you can neglect one, is it because the I don't know what the hell we're doing.
So in the numerical work that you did, is that explicitly with the finite thickness?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. It's fully 3D, and we just apply a distortion to one of the components. So we move.
If you make a cut in the structure, mm-hmm. do you see that would be a way to probing if there is some residual stress? So you know if you could cut along the arrow.
Yeah, there's definitely residual stress, but you mean cutting
around
the circle or?
Yeah, both directions, but
okay.
Yeah, you see if you cut along the diameter, it's going to
yeah,
open
or yeah. I've never cut along the radius. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I'm assuming. I'm sure there is, but I don't know what.
Yeah.
We took this and then we used this kind of model to then do this with swelling, because mechanically stretching these things is kind of a mess and certainly not practical if you want to do something with it. And we can do a lot more with a lot more different geometries if we can do this with swelling. So I'm going to probably, for the sake of time, assume you know something about swelling. If you don't, basically think of a sponge that's dry, dunk it in water, it's going to get bigger. Our materials are like sponges, except they don't swell with water, they swell with organic solvents. But the long and short of it is you have this rubber, which is going to get bigger as you put amounts of solvent in it. We play one more additional trick, which is only interesting to people who like to do really simple experiments, which is we use a material where there's a this pink, we combine a pink silicon rubber with a green silicon rubber, and the only important thing that I want you to think of through the rest of the talk is that the pink silicon rubber has an excess of solvent in it. It's a high molecular weight solvent, so it doesn't evaporate, it just stays in there. And if you put them, some of this pink one with this green one, which otherwise are chemically compatible, they're both silicon rubbers, they're very, very similar. There's just the natural diffusion of those free chains from one to the other. And so the green one loses mass and the pink one gains mass. And so this is a very simple way to play with swelling, because all you have to do is just make two pieces of rubber, stick them together, and then you're gonna have one get bigger and one get smaller. These two circles were the same size. We stuck them together, waited a few days, peeled them apart, and then I'll show you, they're certainly not the same size anymore. So you can get a little bit of intuition for how much kind of growth or shrinkage there is in each side. So you do this, and then you kind of repeat the last experiment that we just did, which is of the annular ring around a circular disk. You know, now there's really no mechanical stretching. All we do is we just stick these two together. They're just perfectly flat. And we just let swelling do the rest, which is the stuff in the pink is going to make the annulus bigger. It's going to make the pink smaller. What you get is something like this. So, you know, these is it for you to play with. And so, you know, we can do this for various different radii ratios of the inner to outer, various different thicknesses, and play with things. And this again, I guess, gets back to Aram's question about, you know, when does some of these things break down. Certainly, so what we're seeing here is a plot of the Gaussian curvature, normalized by the square of the radius of the disk. And then this, on the x-axis, is just kind of this x-axis here, which is how big is that pink disk compared to the total size of the disk. And you see that our analytical theory, the fully analytical one, is the black curve. Kind of small strain-like approximation is this gray dashed line, and you see that we have much better agreement when we're kind of over here than we do as we get over here, which again I think is kind of what you're seeing with in terms of that boundary layer between the two interfaces.
Did you cut the inner circuit to check that when they are separated, both are still flat, or they are?
I've never cut them to see they're still flat, but I've done, so the next set of experiments I'm going to show you is all about the kind of turning these things into cylinders. And in that one, it's very easy for us to do what I was passing around, but where we don't glue them together, we just place them together. And in that case, I can peel them, it'll still be a cylinder, I can peel them apart and they will both be flat. And so by that, I feel confident that it would be flat.
So then here, if the diffusion is, you know, it doesn't homogenize all the way through, right? Then you might have some.
Yeah, if it's not done. Yeah, if it's not fully swollen and kind of in equilibrium in that swollen state, then no, it probably will take on a weird shape. But if it's done, it should.
That was my question: is just how if you know how far the diffusion is happening.
So I have a whole, I can show you, at the end I'll show you a slide on the diffusion. There's an interesting part there, I left it out, but I'll show it to you at the end.
Yeah. Julie Cornfield at Caltech has a system like this where she can define which part acts pink and which part acts green by shining an uneven pattern of UV light.
Yeah.
So then you can do it without cutting and assembling, you can just write it.
Yeah, that would be beautiful. Yeah.
You should talk to Julie.
I should talk to Julie. I know, yeah, I should talk to her, yeah. Excellent.
I've collaborated with her a little bit on this subject.
All right, perfect. Yeah, so let me just move forward. So one of the things that we're doing with this that we haven't finished yet, many of you may have met Marcelo Diaz, he was here a few weeks ago. So one of the things we're doing now is saying, well, what happens if this thing isn't a sheet, which maybe is blasphemous in this workshop, but if it's more of a ribbon, because as it goes to a ribbon, there's really, what you see pretty clearly is that although it's adopting a saddle-like shape, there's actually, you know, this thing is perfectly developable. It's
what's the sequence here?
It's flat.
Is it right to left and then right to left?
It's like this. It's like this.
And back over.
Okay. Yeah. So this is kind of, you know, it's forming a saddle here, but clearly there's really no curvature across the width of it, and so you can kind of see that as you cut it and play with it. This thing's really fun for a variety of reasons, and so I'll pass that around for you to see as well. But this is something I don't know much about, other than to say that we think we can match what Marcelo has done kind of with his problem on the Wunderlich and the kind of ribbons and the Kirchhoff kind of rods and stitching it to what we're doing and seeing where that transition occurs. I don't have any more to add than we're working on it.
Have you observed higher molds, like monkey saddlings?
No. We expect to if we go thinner. We haven't done it. We've tried to go thinner, and we haven't observed higher modes yet, but as we go thinner, we haven't done it in the right scale. Because as we go thinner, gravity starts to kind of play a role as these things get really, really... we want them to still be big, but thin, and so the short answer is no, but we're trying. We know that they should exist, but we haven't seen them yet. We can push on and make
them. They should exist, but they could be unstable.
Yeah, I think another guy who was here, John Gemmer, suggested along with Iran that at some point they should be stable, but we haven't seen them yet. But that might be more of us not trying hard enough.
One question: in your analytics, are you also calculating the diffusion of the solvent? Or are you just
so I left a lot of that out. So
there is in there.
So it's here. It comes in here. We don't really do it. We just do a mass conservation. We say, okay, well, you know, we have some constant for how much is going out and. When I show the dynamic slide at the end, I'll talk about that again. So we do a little bit where we do basically a diffusive model and say, okay, there's going to be a conservation of mass. There's some initial mass that's going to move from inner to outer. And so we've done a little bit on the swelling dynamics, but for the most part, we're just trying to find a way to correlate stretch to essentially a kind of mass uptake, and so.
Well, that's one of the issues. So the chemical potential of the solvent depends on the current stress.
Yeah.
Is that in your model or not?
No,
in your model?
No. But it's in the model that we're, you know, it's one of the things that we are actually trying to do.
A PhD student of Julie Cornfield's has done that model. It's in his dissertation, but it's not published yet. But the dissertation is public. The guy's name is Ryan Turner, and I just met with him on Sunday. He's local to the Los Angeles area.
Sounds good. That up.
It's a long way from Boston.
Long way from Boston, not long way from Santa Barbara.
No.
So the next thing I wanted to show, and maybe this will be quicker, maybe it won't be, is the problem of instead of kind of having this variation occur radially, having it occur in a bilayer. And this is a problem that's really well studied. This is a problem of you know, dating back to kind of the stony formula for deposition of a metal onto a silicon wafer, and you see this bowing of the silicon wafer, and you calculate the stress, the residual stress from the metal deposition. This is work that has been continued forward, especially as you started to play with laminate composites. Laminate composites in which you have uneven curing during heating will lead to these warping structures, and much of this is known, and it's often known for simple shapes. The problem is usually done in one of two ways. You usually kind of write down the equations for thin plates, and then you say something about either assuming a form for the initial displacements or assuming an area stress function, and go through there to calculate things like when it'll bifurcate and what the curvature of the resulting structure is. And we were trying to see if we could apply this model to that for any shape without any introduction of these assumptions. And so this is kind of what we're doing here. You start with the same energy density, and in this case we do expect an isometry in the limit of large stretch. So this is a weird problem, because I'm going to solve it kind of, I'm going to skip to the end and then march backwards. we're going to say, in the limit of large stretching, where you take a bilayer and the top one is stretched a lot and they're glued together, you see bending, we expect this shape to adopt an isometry so we can throw away the bending energy, throw away the stretching energy, and just minimize the bending energy. And so, what we're talking about is this. You know, what is the mean curvature of this shape for any given initial geometry? So this was a circular plate, but you could imagine being whatever you'd like. And so, again, we're doing the same experimental system, which is this residual swelling of the green and the pink materials. And we do our console numerics. This is the same type of stuff that we were doing before, except now it's a bilayer. We're doing a finite elasticity, neo-Hookean incompressible material, and we use distortions to simulate a pre-stretch. So in this case here, the top layer is going to be subject to a distortion. In this case here, it's all swelling. And so you see, as you'd expect, if you're very quick with your eyes, you can see a bifurcation at the beginning here, especially if you focus on this corner, you can see that it's going down initially, and then it bifurcates into a cylinder. You can't really see it in my experiments because they happen so quickly. But this is what we're trying to model here. And what's interesting is that this happens, you know, for any shape. And that's probably obvious to this crowd, but this cylindrical isometry occurs for the kind of bilayer growth of any thin sheet. So this is an oval. It's going to form a cylinder. A rectangle is going to form a cylinder. A plus sign takes a long time, but eventually does bifurcate. I'll come back to that. And this is an arbitrary leaf shape where, again, you see this, you can really clearly see the bifurcation there. And so I'll pass around a couple of these to play with. Note when you're looking at this that you can really see there's a boundary layer near the edge here, which is causing it to...
So why do you say this is an isometry?
Near isometry, I should say, is a better way to say it. It's not a perfect isometry, it's a near isometry. There's some stretching along the outer edge. But the majority of the surface is unstretched.
Okay, so the effective metric of the surface is just the average of the top and the bottom?
2D isometry. We think of it more as a near isometry. And as we see, this is true for any of the shapes we've tried so far. So this has been the weirdest one. This is a plus, a letter T, and it forms a really nice cylindrical shape.
Letter T, if it was long enough these two ways, couldn't it curl both ways?
It can curl both ways. Actually, you can make this one curl the other way.
Or like the leaf or whatever, couldn't you imagine the leaf was thin enough?
Yeah, there's going to be a limit here.
It would all sort of curl in, right?
There's going to be a limit here, and I don't know where that limit is in terms of, like, if you were to make this thing have a very small region in the center and then really large arms, at some point it's going to all come together. I don't know what that limit is, and so we didn't hit it yet, but I assume it's there. So any of these shapes form cylinders. And the question is, you know, can we say something smart about the curvature of these cylinders? And so the way we do that is we throw away the stretching energy by saying that this is, you know, we assume that it's a perfect isometry. It's not, but we make the assumption that it is. We write down the second fundamental form in Cartesian coordinates, and we basically are just using a Lagrange multiplier to enforce that the Gaussian curvature has to be zero in the deformed state. If you do that, you end up with a very, very simple equation for the mean curvature. And you end up that the mean curvature of your cylinder is just going to be equal to 1 plus the Poisson ratio over 2. And then there's just two parameters here. One is the natural curvature. This is the curvature of, if you were to imaginarily cut a beam out of that, this is that curvature. And then this lambda squared is the kind of amount of stretch that you've applied. And so,
what is this big gamma?
Big lambda is it's the distortion of the It's the amount of stretch, essentially, of the top layer. So how much? So if you took it by layer.
When you prepare it, when it is flat.
Yes. So take a by layer.
Yeah.
And say, you know, have it stretched by some amount, lambda naught, capital lambda naught. That's if you take the ratio of what the beam would do to the amount you've stretched it squared, you get the.
So that's just disparity between the top and the bottom?
Yes.
So what is K0 then?
K0 is the amount of the natural curvature if it was in the stress-free configuration. It's the natural curvature of the beam, if you were to imaginarily cut a beam out of it. And so basically what this means is that if you have an isotropic material, if you have a nu is equal to a half, you end up that your mean curvature should just be 3/4 the natural curvature of a beam, given the same amount of stretch. Which means that if you look at a growing cylinder and a beam of the same thickness and bilayer properties, this should be 1.5 times curved what you see in the beam. Yes, Simon?
So it's like kappa naught over whatever it was.
Lambda naught, yeah.
Squared.
Yeah.
Isn't that just a thickness?
Lambda naught is a stretch, and kappa naught is whatever length.
It's probably something like in constant times the thickness.
That's right, but weighted by the disparity between the upper and the lower, right? So if you had no disparity, you wouldn't want to bend at all.
Yeah, but I think the ratio of what the stretch is and how much curvature you end up with is just purely a function of the.
That's right.
I'm sure that's just a thickness.
Yes. So,
yeah, also the curvature for the beam like is directly related to this lambda naught. So why didn't you like separate it out?
Yeah, but that's why I think the thickness can be the only thing that you have there.
Right. I don't understand your question. So you said, you know, like, you calculate the curvature for the hardness.
Because we can do that analytically, right? You can do that analytically.
Of course, but you know, like the curvature depends on exactly your mismatch lambda.
Exactly. So So
why do you have like kappa zero separate from lambda? Why don't you just write
that? Because the mean curvature of the cylinder is going to be dependent on how much you stretch the top layer,
right?
And then it's relative to how much the beam would deform if there was no if it wasn't a sheet, essentially. And so.
So the kappa naught depends on thickness.
Right.
The other thing doesn't depend on thickness.
Right.
So you can write a ratio between the two, and that turns out to be. You're right. So the kappa naught depends on thickness. It also depends on lambda naught.
Yeah.
It's just a possible combination.
Right.
You need one dimension of length somewhere. So that the kappa naught instead of thickness, you write it at kappa.
So put the other combinations.
You could write the example of thickness in lambda.
But you know that this one is the right one. So.
It is the right one because it's calculated.
This is what he's using. You write
So it works for any kind of shape we can draw. We did. I think these are the 5 or 6 we did. The blue ones are our numerics, the red ones are our experiments. And so this works fairly well. This kind of 3/4 law of what the mean curvature should be compared to the curvature of a beam seems to hold for any of these kind of bilayer shapes that we can draw up. We can also go back and do the kind of low stretch problem, which is going to say when's the bifurcation between a spherical cap and a cylinder going to occur, and so we do that by just comparing the energies of a spherical cap to the energies of a cylinder, and you know this is the going back to the very well known problem. It's just doing so without any statement of the displacements or area stress functions, and we can do it for any particular shape, and you see pretty clearly our analytics predict a bifurcation occurring here, and that bifurcation due to COMSOL. Oops, all the way around. COMSOL's bifurcation and our analytical bifurcation are pretty close. This is where one of the puzzles that I mentioned comes in. So here's a plot of the bifurcation curvature as a function of our shape factor. So when you write down the stretching the energy here, the energy to bend this thing into a sphere, there's a nice term here that we separated out and refer to as a shape factor. So it's our way of quantifying kind of any shape. It's a characteristic length of a particular shape. And so we can compare the structural slenderness, which is going to be the thickness, to the characteristic kind of shape of the area. And we see that the bifurcation curvature works really, really well. We can predict when it'll bifurcate for various kind of slender structures, as long as the shape is convex. And so we really don't understand this. And this is kind of one of the puzzles I wanted to pitch to all of you. This work, you know, you can see circles and ellipses, and this is like a, I forget what that shape is, like a, I don't even know. I'll draw it up later. Triangles, rectangles, it works really well. But if you go to the leaf, which falls perfectly on the three-fourths law, where it predicts perfectly well, the leaf has nearly 100% error in when it'll bifurcate compared to when we predict that it'll bifurcate. And if we change this, and we kind of suspect that this has to do with the concavity of the shape, and if we change this leaf here, and so we just slightly vary the shape factor, but we get rid of these really sharp kind of concave little segments there, you know, so we change S by about 1%, we see like a nearly, you know, 70%, 80% drop in the prediction of the bifurcation curvature.
What about just the shape of the convex part? Right.
You haven't done a systematic look.
The largest radius that you can draw from the center. Mm-hmm.
So that we haven't done a systematic look into that. But I know exactly what you mean.
That's your shape factor.
Yeah, maybe that's the shape factor at that point. Is the smallest circle you can draw.
The convex hull, really. So the smallest convex shape that would.
And so I don't know. I haven't verified
the
this.
The convex hull would wrap around. You mean the wrapping around the entire shape? That's.
It would be a square at this
point. I think it's too big.
But that's what he's doing with the shape factor. He's looking at the.
With the shape factor, you're looking at the square, not at the actual shape. So it has to do with how these cylinders can fit together.
The largest convex shape that fits.
Yeah, and so I don't know. So this is something we could look at and verify. I mean, but I wanted to point it out because it's pretty strong deviation.
So what kind of bifurcation is this? What type of bifurcation?
This is just a buckling, a stable symmetric bifurcation as it's going from a sphere to a cylinder.
Which means it is hysteretic, it is bistable, and which would mean you have actually not one point where it happens, but you have two points, one on your way in the one direction and one on your way coming back. Then it would be a little bit defined. So if you have a static transition, you would have an upper sort of critical point and a lower critical point on the way coming up and on the way coming back.
I mean, this is a smooth, but I mean, this should be.
That's why I'm asking what type of bifurcation is it? I mean, is it a static one or is it a.
No, it's a kind of smooth bifurcation.
Smooth,
like,
Not
some sort of limit point or.
It's
not bistable. Okay. But I'm glad you mentioned that. So I'm going to show something.
If you go at the crust of that point where they have the same energy, it should be bistable. Because all intermediate shapes should have a bigger energy.
It suggests that you have crossing energy, so that it means it is bistable.
At that point?
Yeah.
At least
they both have the same energy.
It's because you have a big change.
But the intermediate space is a higher number.
You have a change of symmetry when
you break off.
What are the intermediate states, though? I don't think it's just a smooth change in one radius, right?
Yeah, that's worse because you start from a zone jump.
There's no jump in any other radius.
So it is a continuous transition. It goes from being flat to slowly curving up. So there's no two states.
But isn't it spherical?
Sure, it's spherical and then it jumps into a cylinder. Bistable or not.
That would be bistable.
And if that is bistable, then you have actually two transition points, either coming from the spherical side or coming from the cylindrical side. And then you could get already a variation in your whatever you find because you have actually two.
So as far as we know this in a different context, you have a smooth transition from this
actually bending dominated to stretching dominated in terms of curvature. So one curvature vanishes, but without it doesn't jump to zero.
Okay. It's like I mean, there are other examples of these, like when you have the rubber stretching problem, right, where you have the asymmetric transition from symmetric to asymmetric configuration, and you're stretching along the rubber. It's another smooth case where you have two numbers that smoothly split apart. One gets bigger, one gets smaller. Mm-hmm. You have, I think, the same thing here with the smooth. The sphere starts, one thing starts shrinking,
and then the other one starts growing. Yeah.
It's not like a jump.
All right, this is another puzzle I want to show you. When we make these, so this is going to be different than what you're playing with. What you're playing with, there's some aging to the material. And so what I'm about to say, if you're playing with it, you're going to say that's not true. There's some aging to this material, so it kind of lies. If you let it sit for a long time, this ends up being a preferential curvature. If I try to twist it, it'll go back. But when you first make it and there's no aging yet, you can just spin this thing around. And that's true for any of these shapes. Except, and I'll kind of leave this up there. We can chat about this later. We can actually see that there is a preferred direction in which it'll bifurcate, and the direction is such that it'll bend along the longest length that preserves reflectional symmetry. And so all of these shapes are, you know, this is the longest length that preserves reflectional symmetry. Longest length that preserves reflectional symmetry. In the case of a square, as we go from a square to a rectangle, it's not a smooth jump from bending along the diagonal to bending along this length here. We see that there's a transition here. So if you want to chat about this, I don't have an answer to it, but I'd love to talk later. And I want to finish with a couple of videos that have nothing else except some pictures and motivation for stuff they're working on next. A natural step, at least in our mind, was to go from flat initially to having some sort of initial curvature. So this is a spherical cap that has a green outer layer. So that green outer layer is going to get bigger. The pink inner layer is going to get smaller. And we watch the residual swelling morph this into what appears, in our opinion, to be the same isometry that you see with pollen grains or near isometry. We see from our numerics on this that this is maintaining a constant Gaussian curvature, but we have a lot to do to see if we can say anything else smart about it. If you take this shape here, so this is green on the outside, pink on the inside, and you see this nice pollen grain. If you take this shape here and just do pink on the outside and green on the inside, you see something very different. And so there will be now this kind of bistable snap through. And I think that video is playing, slow motion. So this is just through this growing process, or what we call growing, this swelling process, where this bilayer on the right is bistable, and on the left it's not. And so we see this kind of snap through from one state to the next. One of the other things that we're thinking a lot about, but we haven't really done much on, is this mirror buckling isometry. So if instead of doing a full bilayer, so green fully with pink, we can just do green everywhere here, this is just a spherical cap, and then on the top here, we have a bilayer of pink on the outside, green on the inside. And in that case, instead of seeing the pollen grain isometry, we see this mirror buckling isometry form. Again, this is just pretty pictures, I don't have much else to say. And one final thing is that we're trying to think about now is the effects of the topology of the surface. And I promise I have experiments that look exactly like the video I'm about to show, except I couldn't find any of the pictures. So just believe me that what is about to happen, this is what happens when we do the experiments. So this is just a cylinder in which the outer part of the cylinder is green and the inner part of the cylinder is pink. And these are our numerics. And what you see is that shape. Form. And this is what we see experimentally. I think Jose can confirm. We did this in his lab, so he knows that this is true. I can't find the picture.
Can you get it to invert, to evert, if it's...
I can't get it. We haven't been able to get it to evert, but I haven't played with it enough.
So you have a short cylinder. No, it might.
It might.
Yeah.
We haven't done.
The inside is pink.
The inside is pink, the outside is green.
The outside is getting bigger.
The outside is getting bigger.
Oh, wait, the outside is getting bigger.
Yeah.
So this is just a point when I can release the swelling?
Yep.
Just like alpha inside?
Exactly. Yeah, we just release this from the inside out. And this is what we see, and yeah.
It looks like it's making a tetrahedron.
It does.
Well, it's like an icy.
Anyway, I've taken up more time than I probably should have, but this is kind of the things that we're thinking about, using swelling and growth in thin shells. So.
So can I go to the boat? So I go to the south of the beginning of this. So
yeah, yeah.
So here is what makes me puzzle. Is it better to write here or?
So you plot this kind of a theta theta, right? And it looks like this was R and this was something. This was basically the flat. Sorry, it was the opposite. It's the forward. So this was the flat part, right? So this is basically cost zero bending energy. And then there was this. And then there was something like this. Generally, it was only this because then. Okay. So now let's discuss the bending modulus. Okay, let's call it B. At least in my understanding, how I would address this kind of problem. If the bending is sufficiently small, I don't know then what, but there's some characteristic scale associated with the stretching modulus, the jump in the metric, etc., then the kind of shape will be this kind. And we will follow, bending will not be important anywhere, it will not be important here, it will not be important also here, because this does not cost anything. And here you will have some kind of boundary layer whose scale is going to be like B to some power, some positive power. Maybe 1/2, I know, let me put 1/2 just to be. Now, if the bending is sufficiently large, and the bending is larger than something, which the same something that is here, I would say that what you have is something that is basically going all the way like this, and then maybe at the end it will just kind of do like as we typically see in it will release some deviation of the planar shape. This is typically what we see when we have Euler buckling in cylinder. There is some small boundary layers there. I don't see any regime, any parameter regime in which the two terms that you have are imposed.
So your second picture, you just make the parabola go higher so it matches one at the bottom and the other at the bottom.
Yeah, but why? This cost bending energy. It's important, the bending. Here the bending is large.
So you're costing stretching.
You're costing a lot of stretching by doing this, so you want to average the two metrics.
What parameter regime? Tell you where bending, how the bending
that
should
be. That is the regime. When your thickness is big, your bending is not...
But bending is important.
It is.
Is large.
Absolutely. But so is stretching. And you will have
little bending. Bending is more important than stretching. Then it will tend to this kind of thing. This is one asymptotic limit. This is another asymptotic.
But you can have this. This is buckling threshold. Beyond the buckling threshold, in a way. This is what you drew. It's a parabola. It's a flat disk.
So this will be beyond the buckling threshold.
This is the buckling threshold. Then when you buckle, you still can be...
When you go away from the buckling, then you go to
one scale.
Right? This is what you call buckling threshold, this is what you call...
Are you saying that
but you have
in
the middle,
also in cost anything in this room? Less cost less than bending in this
not
room?
Here.
What you're saying.
Not when you're in threshold. When you're in threshold, you know, you don't have enough bending, you have too much bending cost to go out of plane. Then you have every real planar, except maybe...
Because it's thick, you're saying.
Yeah, this is C, and this is C. So I don't know what is in between.
But why isn't there something in between?
But the third parameter regime, tell me what B should be, how the bending should scale in order to have something.
In terms of the boundary layer, it should be bigger than the thickness and smaller than the distance of the radius from the boundary, right?
So the asymptotic regime, then tell me what T, the thickness is what? Is
so the thickness is smaller than square root of the, let's say, kappa times the thickness.
What is kappa? This
No, this kappa is the induced curvature, you know, in a sense. So
then kappa. This is the other kappa, yes.
Times t.
Right.
Okay. And this is smaller.
So
no, on the other side, no.
This is the green one.
Right, and then smaller, also smaller than. Square root of kappa t is smaller than?
Yes.
the distance between the cutoff and the edge.
Distance
between the radius of the distance.
Yes, exactly, from that.
Okay, so only in this regime, this picture is going to be valid.
The Doug's picture, right? The one in which
the stretching is the dominant energy and the bending is whatever you get.
So you see that in this regime, you will have, you will, because it's finite size, you would like, well, it's not finite size.
That's why I said bending. I think if you increase the size of this thing, you'll start seeing the first thing that you drew.
Where that elastic length is on roughly on the size of the disk, right? That
length, the boundary.
Yeah, the boundary layer happens to be about the size of the disk.
So in this regime, you're expecting to see what he said, which is kind of.
What you should do, you should estimate the width of the transition.
The boundary
measure. Yes. And in this regime, the transition is comparable to the system. What you see is the normal.
It's fine.
If you take the outer radius to be larger, then the transition will be smaller, and then outside, this argument will not.
Well, I think maybe we need to break up into smaller group discussions at this point. Let's thank Doug.